Accession number 22333, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Jim McKenzie in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 7th of the 8th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. I wanted to ask you what the attitude towards the British by the local people in Bombay was at that time, 1942.
Never discussed it. The only people we actually met, our little group, as I said, the sixes, seven of us, were up at the British people, very British people, up in the swimming baths. And those places, we never encountered any British people at all, or occasionally we'd meet one, but out at the race course was mostly Indians. Higgins was an Australian trainer, but otherwise we never spoke to any British people that I can remember. But the thing that shocked us so much was the poverty in Bombay. I mean, the soldiers could go anywhere except into the higher echelons or the hotels and things like those places. But you'd go anywhere in the poorer parts of the city, and you see these thousands and thousands of natives lying on the pavement, sleeping on the pavement. Some had little maps. The pavements were covered with betel nut juice, and the betel nut juice. And you'd go down through the red light area. It wasn't called a red light area. It was called can't think of the name for the moment. Where all the prostitutes, they weren't known as prostitutes, they were just known as the lower class, I suppose. And there they were in cages, all alongside the roads. And the cages had their prices up. So many, you've seen some through rupees. That was a high rate of pay, rupee. You saw Annas, so many Annas, and you'll see there'd be an old hag in a cage, and for a few Annas you get along and you'd be a younger lady, and one that was saying called a lady, a younger woman, and you get along and see a child, and which was more expensive still, but I can't think of the name. It's not the fortress. I can't think of the name of the street, the main street that we used to see. But we never lingered there. We went around and we looked at the old fortresses, but we didn't have much time. Three days is not a long time to spend there. And then we were recalled to the ship, and no longer on the Ile de France. We went onto a little Polish ship, coal burner. And from there we were told, or we thought, we were going up to Java. Now, first they said we were going to Burma. Then they said we were going to Java. Now, we weren't sorry to come away from the Middle East. We'd had it. Except for the two Arab cities we'd seen, Tel Aviv and Haifa. Jerusalem was a commercial show. And we weren't sorry to leave the Middle East. We'd suffered very heavily in Syria. We'd lost so many officers and men in Syria. And we were very sorry about the commandos, the way they were slaughtered. But it seemed to be the British way. They didn't do much planning. They just sent their commandos in. And to send them in like they did on the shore, against fortifications in the middle of the night with no supporting artillery, anything, was just murder. And that's how they murdered. They suffered very heavily. The commanders who I met and led up to the river, they didn't suffer heavily at all. They got off very lightly. Because by that time we'd attacked up a lot higher up the river and more or less outflanked the Froggies, the Vichy. But as I said before, we weren't sorry to leave the Middle East.
What was the feeling on board the ship on the coal burner on the way to where you thought Burma?
Now we got on this coal burner. It's called the Kosciuszko. It's about 5,000 ton, 5,000-6,000 ton coal burning. It did about 9 knots. That was its top speed. And we were on this ship, and it was a really tough ship, really tough. It had been the Polish crew, it was all Poles. The Polish crew hadn't been home to, they were out of Danzig, the port, and they had not been back since the outbreak of war. They knew nothing about their relatives, or their people back in Poland. They didn't have a clue. That they'd known Poland had been overrun, but they didn't have a clue. I only spoke to one or two of them. One or two could speak fairly good English, but they just didn't have a clue about the homeland, and we felt very, very sorry for them. The afterguard, or whatever they call it, down the stoke hole in the engine room, they were Indians, and we didn't see much of them for the start. Anyhow, we headed off, and we joined this convoy, fairly hard convoy, and we got to Colombo, and we allowed off in Colombo for 2 days while it cold. And now they cold in the same old way of carrying from a lighter, carrying the coal aboard in baskets. The coolies carrying these baskets up a plank and tipping the coal into the bunkers from the basket. Very, very crude idea. But the way they did it, and I suppose they finished coal burning ships. And we saw a little bit of, we didn't go up to Candy, we just saw a little bit of Colombo, not very much. And then we still didn't know where we were going. We were told we were going to Burma. It didn't make us very happy.
Why?
Well, we weren't going home. That's why. We didn't want to go into the unknown sort of business.
Was there a sort of sense of urgency on board ship about...
No, never had a clue. The old thing plodded along at 8 or 9 knots. We were given the old cork life jackets. I think we had about 1,200 men on this little small ship. We knew that there were boats for about 200 or 150. There were a few rafts there, but we knew that if we went down, there wasn't a dog's chance of any survivors.
Was there a concern that the Japanese might be out there?
No, never worried about it at all. Never worried about it. All we worried about, the tucker was shocking. It was absolutely shocking, the tucker. They had kidneys, the men issued. I think the sergeant had a little bit better than the men, as usual. The officer had better than the sergeants. But we messed on our own. And these kidneys were in wooden casks. I can say in a brine in wooden casks. And they served out to the troops. They had breakfast, a cup of kidneys for breakfast. And I walked along. I had to do inspection of the tuck and stand by the tuck while it had been served and things like that. And one of the chaps bounced a kidney on the deck, and blow me dead, it came up for about 2 feet. It was just like a golf ball. And that's how they were. It was absolutely shocking tucker. Really bad tucker. And, of course, the British rations, and they only didn't worry about what the troops got. Same everywhere we saw with the British. And anyhow, we came out of the way, and then we turned around and went back to Colombo. And then the blacks in the hole, the Indians, went ashore and never came back. They mingled with the coolies carrying the coal aboard, and went ashore and never came back. So that meant that we had to man the firing in the ships, and I was put in charge of of my crowd, my platoon, and I went down there. And actually it was the coolest part in the ship where I was, because I stood under one of those round draft funnels, fans sort of business, and the air came down to the top. It might be hot up there, but by the time it came down in front of the furnace, it was cool. And all the men suffered. They had to stoke the boilers, and it did in shifts, of course, very short shifts, because they couldn't take too much of it. One of my chaps, chap from my hometown, big strong cove, he did his back in, and he was got out of the army when he came back to Australia, his bad back, and he suffered from his bad back till the day he died. But he, it was an art, they learnt it, how to throw the coal in. They were taught it, of course, by the engineers, and that was a job I was given. But we had no moon, we were very, move on the ship, we were very cramped. We had one chap could sing fairly well, and he used to sing at night time. He could be heard all over the ship. But the second time we left Colombo, and the next morning, looked out, nearly said a porthole, but you couldn't see out the portholes because all the portholes were always shut. During the war, every porthole was locked tight, so make it watertight. But out on deck, and looked out on deck early morning, stand to, and there was this whopping rig battleship, a tremendous battleship. Of course, we weren't supposed to know the name of it, and it was a war spider, one of those battleships, British battleships, tremendous thing, right alongside us. And we were in a big, very large convoy. And the...
What was the sense of morale on board ship?
No morale. We just lived as we were. Just talked to each other and did a bit of PT exercise wherever we could.
What were some of the things that you talked about amongst yourselves?
Well, I just can't remember about it. We just talked about... You had a good horse, you had a good horse back on the farm. You had a good dog, you had a good dog back on the farm. If a chap was working in an office, I suppose he discussed his law cases or something like that. If you're doing law or accountancy, you just discussed it. Discussed what sport you played on a weekend, where you played cricket or football or you swam or something like that.
Did you talk about the war in relation
to soldiering? Never discussed
the
war. Never discussed the war. We didn't know anything about the war. We didn't know what the war was happening. We knew that the Japanese were into it well and prone. We'd heard about Singapore, I think in Bombay, or just before you got to Bombay, we heard about Singapore.
Well, how did that affect the morale of the troops when you'd heard that Singapore had fallen?
Well, we didn't understand it. Just didn't understand it. We hadn't heard it. They never told us anything about the two British battleships being sunk.
Did you hear about the 8th Division going?
No, we didn't even know about the 8th Division. We knew that British, Australian troops up there, but we didn't know about the 8th Division or anything else. We weren't told anything during the war.
Did you have any idea of the fighting ability of the Japanese?
No. look, we had no idea what was going on. Before the war, when I was a child, after the... what we call the Great War, the 1914-18, was the first war, became the first war after it. But we as a child always knew it as the Great War. That was a description, the Great War. And when we'd go up in King's Park, and there'd be, on the weekend, and there'd be scores of Japanese up there, little fellas with glasses on, very, very polite, chattering away, and we didn't have a very high opinion on them.
Why not?
Well, because they're small, and they had wore glasses, and they used to chatter. I said, that's why not. We knew anything about them. At sports, we never knew anything about them, anything else. And we were very interested in sport. If they'd been good cricketers or tennis players or anything like that, we would have had known about them, but we didn't. All the Japanese we ever encountered were the ones in the laundry where you took your shirts to. You took your clothes to. If you wanted to have a stiff shirt, you took it to... The Japanese, they had more laundries than the Chinese, I think. And we used to take it to Japanese. They're the only Japanese we ever saw, except these Japanese sailors up in Kings Park. We had no idea about the Japanese. Anyhow, we got into the swapping big convoy, and this battleship, there might have been battleships on the other side, but we were right up close to it all the time. And we saw destroyers and cruisers out on the flanks, and we couldn't understand. Then somebody told us, oh yes, we're there to protect the battleship. And that was the whole idea. We're there to protect the battleship if the attack, a torpedo, anything else sort of business. They came, got us first, and then we said, oh yeah, but then they'll fire over the top of us. And that's the idea, they'll protect us there. And they said, if they fire over the top of us, all your eardrums will be busted in no time.
How did it feel to know that you were sort of the protection for the battleship, that you were going to be the decoy, as it were?
Well, that's what we were told we mightn't have been. That might have been a furphy. But that what we were told, that we were there, and we were crowded up against the battleship. It was there to protect us by firing over the top of us, and we were protected with the torpedoes and things like that. But the... Well, we were close and guarded in there. We were only doing about 8 or 9 knots. And I'd been down the stoke hole all the time, or on and off. Came up every hour and a half, I think it was. Not 2 hours, hour and a half, I think it was. And then we turned around and went off with this mob and a big convoy. And we were very, very lucky because we were slow. The faster troops went in and landed in Java. The 2nd, 3rd machine gunners, who had been with us all along in Northern Camp and in Syria, fortress in Syria, they landed in Java and they eventually captured. But there again, we heard that a lot of their guns and everything else was the same as Greece, happened in Greece and Crete, weren't on their ship that they were on. They had no room to put them on their ship. And they weren't on there, so they were only, say, half-armed. And it was the way that they did it. They loaded the ships, and I believe in Crete. I spoke to chaps after the war, a friend of mine I knew before the war, and they knew after the war. And they told me they went to Greece and didn't have a gun, because the guns had been loaded on a different ship. The ammunition had been loaded on a different ship to what they were. The artillerymen were on a different ship. And that's what happened to them. And eventually, they were given Italian captured guns. And when they went to Crete, this friend of mine, he got an MM, and he was using an Italian gun that was captured in the desert. But they weren't using their own 25 pounds at all, never fired their 25 pounds because they never had them.
When was it that you realised that you were coming back to Australia?
When we split the convoy. When we turned left, the big ships left us, the warships left us, and we didn't know they left because they never do it at night time. But we turned, we went up there into the... I was wrong there. The first time we left Colombo, we went up at what they call the Spatler Straits. We got up some distance before we turned around and went back to Colombo. And that was when we went to Colombo, and then that's when Curtin won his argument that we weren't to go to Burma. We didn't know anything about this. We read about after the war that Churchill wanted us to go to Burma, and we were going to Burma till Curtin said no, they had to come home. We want them home. You've still got the 9th Divy in the Middle East. We want the 7th Divy and the 6th Divy home. And that's when we turned back from the Straits and came home to Fremantle. And there again was the most stupid thing in the world. We were on this little Kosciuszko and... We were on this for quite a few weeks too. Terrible. And of course, the Australian people, the heads, who couldn't run a bakery, they couldn't do a darn thing. The top army command and that sort of thing. They anchored us out in the also harbour in Fremantle, and we were anchored there. And they let the 2nd, 14th, and 2nd, 27th have a day's leave in Fremantle. And they had their day's leave in Fremantle. I don't know what happened. I just can't remember what happened about that. What happened when they put back on the ship and then went away to South Australia. But all I know, we were anchored off Fremantle, inside of our hometown, and weren't allowed ashore. And eventually, we went ashore. We got the commission to go ashore. We went ashore, and they gave us 12 hours leave in hometown Fremantle. And the troops went ashore, and I don't know, it was a very distressing story. But they went ashore in Fremantle, and they were supposed to be back at such and such a time on the ship at night. And they went back, or most of them went back, and leave was extended, and they went off again, and then they decided to blow the war. They were going home to see their people. And so they went to the railway station. They caught a train down, say, to Bunbury, Barrackup, wherever the people lived. And when they got there, they were arrested. So actually, they never saw their people. A lot of them had 18 months in the Middle East. They came back to Australia. They landed in their hometown, and they were never allowed to see their people. I was lucky, because I went ashore, I rang up my farm, 60 miles out of Perth, and my sister, my aunt, came down and met me in Perth, and I spent that night in Perth with them, and I went back on the ship next day. So actually I had 2 days. We were given extended leave for 2 days in Perth.
What did you do in that time, the short period of time that you
had? I visited my club. I had a meal at my club.
Which was where?
The WA Club in Perth, West Australian Club. And the rest of the time I spent with my sister and aunt in their hotel room and talking to them. And I slept that night at the club. And I took one of my friends back, and he stayed with me at the club. And we went back next day. And when we went back next day, we got on the Kosciuszko, and we went off to Adelaide, to Springbank, military camp in Adelaide, on the outskirts of Adelaide. But unfortunately, about 140, 150 of the troops didn't return. They went up to Kalgoorlie, and up there they were entertained by the mayor, given a wonderful welcome. And the saying was quite a long time after that, if you were to say, "How are you getting on?" it's a you for mayor, greeting. That was a greeting, because the mayor gave them such a wonderfully good time, opened the city to them. And they up there. Well, we went on to Springbank and camped in Adelaide. And of course, the troops were AWL. They'd been rounded up at their homes and places in the country. Mostly in the country, boys, country men. And they'd been rounded up and put under guard and sent back under guard to Springbank and Adelaide. They arrived back about 10 days, fortnight later, if I remember rightly.
I wanted to
know. And then they were put in a kind of barbed wire entangle camp in the middle of our camp in Adelaide. and they're semi-court-martialed for the business and given punishment.
Did you ever consider going AWL?
No. What? I'd never considered, and I had my people in Perth, perhaps. If I'd had to go up to Northam, I might have considered it.
What were you able to discuss with your sister and aunt? Did you talk to them about...
I talked to them about the farm, and my friends, they asked me how I knew so-and-so, and I'd say, yes, I knew him. What happened to him? I said, oh, he'd be killed. And that was it. We talked about his people and things like that. We just talked about the war. How it affected us. I asked my sister. I'd handed over to her. I'd done a nasty thing to her. I'd walked out on her and left her in charge of the farm, which was a rather rotten thing to do. And I asked her how things were going up there and all about all the people in the neighbourhood, whether Tom had joined up, whether Dick couldn't join up because he had four or five kids and things like that. We just discussed those sort of things. We never discussed the war.
You didn't discuss, for instance, the threat of the Japanese at all?
Oh, we knew the Japanese. We went into a restaurant in Perth, down here in Cottesloe, and you see a big poster up there with a nasty-looking Jap holding a bayonet and a rifle and a baby or something like that. I don't know, I was just wrong, the baby of the First World War. But a nasty-looking Jap with a nasty grin in his face, a lot of buck teeth, and a big sign up saying, "He is coming south. He is coming south." And preparing the population for getting them really scared. Potts, our brigadier at that stage, he nearly went mad. He tore every told the troops to tear every poster that they could see off.
Why do you think that?
Because it was such a thing scaring the people. So put the wind up them, scared them. No sign of that. Scaring young children and everything else. Once you're scared, you're scared, and you can't stop being scared, I suppose. Anyhow, that's how it was. And
what were some of the precautions that you could see that the locals were taking in regard the coming of the war, the closing in of the Japanese, for instance?
Oh well, when we came to Fremantle Harbour, we passed a submarine just going out, so the American submarines were here then. And otherwise we didn't notice much activity because, of course, we didn't notice it. We got on the train and came up to Perth, and there we rang up the people. Of course, they didn't know we'd come across. They didn't know we'd arrived in Fremantle. It was all hush-hush as far as that went. It was later on that everywhere the weapon pits were dug and foxholes were dug and bunkers were dug and things like that. But at that stage, I don't think there were anything like that taking place. They hadn't realised the Dutch people had come down. There were Dutch people here, I believe, but we never saw them. But that's how it was. We got in the ship and went back to Adelaide. And there I was leaving the battalion, I was going to get a commission in another militia crowd, and I refused to go. I said I didn't want to go, and I kicked up a stink, and one of the company commanders saw it my way, and so I was posted to a sergeant to the Orley chapter in AWL. And when they were tried, they just were semi-tried. They didn't know all they got was 5 days. Or I had a week's pay docked to them, or 5 days, no leave, or something like that, which didn't mean a thing. I shouldn't have said that. It did mean a thing, because as they came back into camp, were there, the rest of the battalion moved, got their 5 days leave. 5 days in Perth, that is, we came over here, they said it took 3 days to get over here on the train, you got 5 days in Perth, you had that, and then you went back again. Actually, some of them had more than 5 days, they had a week or something like that in Perth. And they got their leave, but the chaps who had been AWL on court never saw their parents, this is a fact. They went away in from here in Australia in 1940. They fought in the Middle East. They came back. And they never saw their people again. They were killed in New Guinea. They never saw their people again. Never had a chance with them. Just the Australian Army. If they brought them ashore the first time, instead of seeing the 14th and 27th come ashore, everything would have been all right. We all thought that. But it was the way the army did it. Some bureaucrat decided that was it. And as a result, a unnamed chap now, a friend of mine who never saw their parents or their people,